Beyond. On Wolf Spirit Radio, No Borders Radio, and everbeyond.info. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond. March 16th, 2014, Ever Beyond on Wolf Spirit Radio and No Borders Radio and everbeyondradio.com. Welcome, everybody. There's a sense of newness and vibrant energy going around. It feels like we've just kind of been through another, potential end of the world disaster thing, March 15th, the Ides of March, and there is a sort of psychological bump as we near the end of the astrological year. We're just finishing it next week, where the equinox is. We're gathering our crystals, and we were talking in the last show about Shungite, which is an ancient stone found in Russia, which is very purifying, that guards against the rather erratic energy sometimes of digital equipment that is all based on the silicon crystal. And we were talking about the form of crystals in the last show, also about the form of crystals being caused by the form of the nucleus and the electron shells around them being actual geometric forms rather than fuzzy spheres or clouds or whatever, but they're actual geometric forms, which is why crystals have their particular form. Anyway, when we deal with a certain crystal, is silicon, we even have a whole part of the world dedicated to it and the energy that feeds it. The silicon consciousness that has spread across the world, it's ubiquitous, as they say. It's everywhere. Silicon exists in all forms. We see through it in glass. We use it in all forms of cookware, and we are composed of it in our bones, and it's what makes up the solid crystalline world. It makes up the crystalline chip that is that what we call integrated circuits that make computers, and the crystal oscillator that runs everything, the little heartbeat of the device. Everything has a heart, and silicon lies at the heart of devices in the world. Devices running on very tiny amounts of electricity, moving very fast and sprinting, anyway. But they are a consciousness. It's a crystalline consciousness, and it's part of the consciousness of the planet, in my humble. And the manifestation of that consciousness has occurred through various aspects, but they all seem to end up in California, somewhere in the nice warm climate where things are kind of easy, and you don't have to think, you don't have to think about survival much, and it's a place where you can think about other things. And so from that, I would like to welcome my new correspondent from Silicon Valley, Sharon Barrington. Welcome to Ever Beyond.
Thank you, JP. It's nice to hear from you. Nice of you to ask me to join your show.
Ah, well, it's good to have you here. You called in last week when I was on the Revolution Radio, and how did you find it?
Oh, Revolution Radio. Well, I started out listening to Sean David Morton, and I think you're the producer once a week there, right? And I know you also have had a show other places, right? And you used to be, what was your other co-host? It was JP and the lady.
And Rebecca Jernigan.
Yes, yes. So I first heard you with Rebecca. And you guys were a great duo, very dynamic duo. And then I heard you with Sean David, and I also know you have your own show. So you started talking about what intrigued me to call, of course. We started talking about Alex Collier and a great letter from him, very timely. And I just thought, I've got to call JP and see what's going on. Wow. And then from there, it was a great, kind of a great connection, I thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just seems like the level that you're talking is just exactly the kind of level that I am corresponding on, if you see what I mean. This is, you know, the kind of things that I talk about the way that consciousness and matter and all these things are interconnecting, and that, you know, we're spiritualizing matter, and part of the spiritualization of matter is the building of the silicon consciousness. War, we could say the manifestation of the silicon consciousness, because it's already, or it probably already exists everywhere else.
Yeah, I think that I've always looked at it that way myself. And, you know, I've had a couple of experiences that are just absolutely incredible. Like, there was a number of times I can remember going to conferences or being in rooms where it's like the smartest people in the valley all congregated for some reason. And I think it was Anita Borg. Is that her name? Anita, yeah. She was a smart guru. And she would bring people together and she'd do conferences. And I finagled my way to one of her conferences one time. And they were like $2,500 for 4 days or something. The room vibrated at such a high level that I felt like my brains left my head, or some kind of energy left the top of my head, and you could just feel that technical, or what do you want, a spiritual, energetic connection with everybody, because everyone was just so smart. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience. Maybe that's what people feel in music concerts or things like that every once in a while. You go to a concert and think, oh my God, we all left the planet for 2 hours together, right? And to be in a room with that kind of intelligence and people's synapses snapping, and you can see it and feel it and vibrate at that, just you think, I just want to be here forever. I want to be this excited, moved, whatever, forever. You know, and I think that it's such an addiction here to learning and finding out new things, and it just pushes your brain to think differently in so many different ways. And I've often wondered if the reason it's California is the weather's great, which I think gets people out of their homes. So we're never stuck in our house any day because of the heat or the snow, right? So we can be outside every day. And I think that might have something to do with it. And then we just all seem to congregate here. The money's here, the weather's here, the beautiful planet is here. And I think California has always been sort of a home, and everybody makes fun of it, fruits and nuts. But I think people who may not fit in a box in their state or where they're living roll their way out here, or New York City or someplace like that, where they feel like they can be more themselves. And so I think that's what inspires a lot of things here as well. People come here because they have ideas and they feel like, I can make it happen there. It's just like at one time, right, you went to New York because if you were an actor, that's where Broadway was. And you needed that, or you go to LA because you want to be in the movies. You just kind of go where it goes. And I think that just kind of perpetuates the whole myth, and then perpetuates everything that's going on here. So it's kind of, and I guess the term originally just referred to the large number of silicon chips and innovators and manufacturers. And so it just got, that term caught on, Silicon Valley. Sometimes I call it Silicon, but Yeah,
well, of course. There must be moments of disillusion. What is it really called? What's the real name of it?
No, it is, that's what we call it.
Yeah, it's Silicon Valley, but like Jewish names. What was it before? You know.
Well, it technically it's the San Francisco Bay Area or near Northern California or San Jose. So San Jose is a pretty big city, and around it is the Cupertino, Los Gatos, Santa Clara, you know, that kind of thing. About an hour north of San Francisco. So you'd call us the Santa Clara Valley, right, with San Jose in it, and then 60 minutes north is San Francisco. So that would be San Carlos and Millbrae and all that stuff up that way, Sausalito, and that would be more the San Francisco Bay Area. Now, interesting, we've got the new technology, the digital health. A lot of the new startups are actually in San Francisco itself. I think the rents are a little bit more reasonable right now, and a lot of startups are in San Francisco. You still have a lot Alto, Los Altos area. You've got Stanford University that gets a lot of money from DARPA and those guys. And then San Jose, to me, is typically more the has often been the manufacturing side of things. So that's kind of how it rolls out.
Excellent. So that's the place. The time, the time span of your experience there. Now, when I started in computers, I was in my late teens, and I just left school, and I found myself in a computer reception running an IBM 360, and you know, a big old room full of machines. What's the sort of times? You know, how did? Because you came in not necessarily from the computer angle, did you?
Actually, my first job was working in manufacturing. I worked for a place called Benson Varian, and we did printer plotters. So those machines could literally print out the whole face of the moon or something along those lines. I remember I actually got a copy of it and just strewn it on my wall. It's like there was the moon.
Oh, large-scale prints is lovely.
Yeah, and so helping to make motherboards, right? Little part, you know, gathering parts and making motherboards. That wasn't a fun job, and from there I got a couple of small jobs, but I saw this rainbow-colored apple when I used to go to work, and I used to think, wow, I wonder what that is. Now, mind you, I have no degree. I have a couple of years of college. I'm not technical. I'm really good at project management. I finagled away, I think, through a lot of meditation and prayer and luck. I got a job working at Apple Computer for the guy who did the work on the original 2E. And his name was Walt. Can't remember his last name, but Walt. He actually got to sign his name on a motherboard. I mean, that's unusual. The engineers don't usually get to do that, but that hit the 2E. I don't know if you remember the Apple 2E. That was his baby. And I am not a programmer. I never figured out how to use the 2E. The first computer I actually could figure out how to use, because it was for me, and this is a sad secret but true, was Lisa, because Lisa and Mac were very similar. And the three big divisions I worked at Apple was the 2E, then I worked in Lisa, and then Lisa was actually a pretty good company or computer, and a lot of those engineers, when Lisa wasn't successful, they went off to Sun Microsystems. So all those engineers left, and then I ended up in Macintosh, where Steve Jobs was there the first time. So my run at Apple was from 1980 to 1984. So I was there for the announcement. I was actually six cubes down from Steve Jobs. I wasn't a friend of his. But it was a very exciting time, and I think the thing that I loved about it is I knew it was. I knew where I was, how exciting it was, and what an amazing opportunity this was, especially with someone without a degree. Because after a while, they only hired people from Yale and Harvard and Stanford and Ivy League colleges after that. So I was very lucky.
I'm exactly the same. That I got into these places. I got into university, and I got into a university pay grade, and I didn't have a degree. So I was able to work in a university without a degree, and that stopped. So, you know, long time. You know, once I was there.
Yes, yes. So pretty blessed.
Just
and
behind
very
the
lucky.
Gates. Yeah.
Pretty funny.
So.
Yes.
Steve Jobs, 4 cubes away. What was he then?
He was the head of the division for Macintosh. And I think rumor was that then we had John Sculley, right? Now, I worked on a project with Mike Markula. Markula was the CEO before Sculley. And Markula was amazing. Markula was one of my favorite CEOs ever that I work for. And I didn't know it was his project, and I was scared to death to do a project because I thought, boy, this can't screw up, right? This is for the CEO. Luckily, we were successful, and he took all of us out to dinner with his wife, Mike Markula, and they told Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak stories at dinner. Very, very funny. I guess the first trade show that they had the Steve, they called them the Steves. They had the Steves go with them to demo the 2E, right? Because that's what Steve Wozniak and those guys, they created that. So they went to it, and they brought no money. They had nothing. I guess they just showed up, and the Markulas paid for everything at the trade show. You know, like a room to stay in. Stuff like that. But they just, they told very loving stories of the boys. And because they were in their 30s or 40s, and I think the guys were really young, maybe 20s or something. I didn't meet Wozniak. I think he had left Apple by the time I got there. But it was wonderful to have dinner with Mike Markula. Just as I said, he was the one who instituted the rule that if you work for the company, you got a free computer. Because he felt like that if you were using the computer, you would sell it to your family and friends. Very smart. So we all got a computer, and you had to be there a year, and they gave you a computer. And, you know, it was back in the time where they didn't even know what to do with computers. And then came the printer, right? And that's what gave Macintosh some meaning, because now we could do desktop publishing. And that turned things around. But I think Steve Jobs wanted to run the company then, because that, I mean, Apple was his baby, but he had hired Sculley, and I think he even admitted hiring him was a big mistake. I think at one point in some interview, he said that was a big mistake. Sculley was a very cold person, and kind of like an ice cube. I just remember that was my first impression of him. I didn't like him. The company changed after he got there. He was brought there to make it a more quote-unquote legitimate company and something that Wall Street would be willing to invest in. And
was he the first Mason?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't think about him very often. I didn't like him, so I don't think about him very often.
Interesting.
You know, it's just something I don't dwell on. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So, long story short, Steve Jobs, I think, actually was booted out of the company about 3 or 4 months before I was. It's either before or after. I think it was before. Anyway, so he left. He and Sculley got in a face-off of some sort, and then, boom, out goes Steve Jobs, and he goes off to do that new company next. And then I went off to work at Olivetti. So then I went over to Olivetti, where we did the 286 computer. Olivetti was a clone company from Italy, where, remember when the big thing, you either did Apple or Unix, or you did clones of IBMs. Remember, that was kind of the big thing.
Yeah, yeah. I worked mainly on the AT and the clones. The Clone Wars, yeah. Installing clones in London University, yeah.
Exactly. So that's kind of part of my history. And I did 6 years at Olivetti and many trips to Italy, and then went off to Silicon Graphics, which was another amazing adventure to be there and to be there at that time where it was at the top of its form. And I had a really good time there. I was a consultant there. Again, they wouldn't hire me because I didn't have a PhD, but they let me work there for 6 years. Funny, huh? I mean, to me, it's very funny. But anyway.
Well, so. You know, this is. I mean, you've no idea how many people we've spoken to who have fallen through their lives in these incredibly fortunate circumstances that don't seem to have anything to do with, you know, what they're actually qualified to do, and they feel like frauds all the way through, but they're actual, you know, you're witnesses. You're here to witness it, and here you are, you're bearing witness to it, and, you know, go for it, because you have, I can see and feel that you have compassion for everybody, and so you're a compassionate historian, which is a great thing.
Well, thank you. Some days, you're catching me on a good... I'm on the radio. I'm going to come off very compassionate, just to be fair, because my friends are in the chat room, and I don't want them to think I'm frauding you out here. But today we're being very up and positive. Ever beyond. Anyway.
Beyond. Yeah, I mean, basically, I and my listeners are building up a knowledge of history, of like where we come from, who we are. And I get people who tune in, and I see them there, but I don't see them in the chat room. So hello to everybody who's out there and not in the chat room. They come week after week, and we're building up a view of the world. And it's a bit like kind of every, you know, you're trying to lift up a huge, like a huge barrel or something, like a 15-foot barrel, and you put a wedge underneath one side and you can get a little bit underneath, and then you can bring another wedge, a slightly bigger wedge, and put that in because you've got the little wedge in, and gradually we can raise the thing and see what's underneath it, and every guest brings along their little wedge, their little piece of the puzzle that can crack open the mystery a bit further for everybody to see, and that's what we're seeing. So this is part of the mystery, and it's part of like how the higher consciousness has evolved, broken out, as it were, onto the planet. Some of the characters involved. I mean, do you know any? Have you met Bill Gates?
I haven't met him. One of my older bosses, this is where I'm not so compassionate, one of my old bosses, actually, when she left Apple, she ended up working for Bill Gates. And she said that Bill Gates made Steve Jobs look like an angel. I guess Bill Gates was not an easy person to work for. A lot of people did very well at Microsoft. But it's funny. I never really cared if I ever worked there. It wasn't my thing. You know what I mean? Just yep. Wasn't inclined to go there. It didn't have, it's like what I looked for in a company. I was lucky to find a number of times. One of them was at Apple. The other was at Silicon Graphics. And it was a sense of freedom, a sense of like a sense of innovation and some joy and some fun. And I know that the Microsoft people touted that, but I never had a sense of that. Whereas I did at Silicon Graphics and I did at Apple. And, It kind of comes with its own sort of insanity and craziness, but it's such a much more fun environment. And I never would have fit in at an IBM or a much more stable, standardized kind of company. I don't do well at companies like that at all. You know, the only one I really kind of made it through was Olivetti, and the reason I made it through that is we worked at the satellite office in Cupertino.
Yeah, so I can imagine that.
You probably know the Italians being over that way. So,
yeah,
you know.
So it's, I mean, Olivetti, it was a much more kind of relaxed kind of machine. And
yes.
And, you know, all the machines, all the software reflect the companies that created them, the minds of the people that they squirted out from in the first place. You know, so with Bill Gates, it comes with this highly flawed but rather Nazi, but kind of bolted together, monstrosity of actually, it's a bit like the Borg that absorbs all technologies around it, it's created a monster that is, it's beyond Bill now, it's going to eat everybody. And Bill seems to have gone along his megalomaniac way and think, that humans are far too populous and we should vaccinate them to death and all of that stuff. So we know that. I was aware of IBM. I had an ex-girlfriend who worked at IBM as well, and getting to know the mentality of the people that IBM were adding machines and what grew out of the IBM, what becomes the PC, is basically an adding machine, whereas the Apple was designed from the ground up to be something different. It wasn't an adding machine, it was a creating machine.
Right, right. And I think that's the thing that I really, I think during the time I was there, I think that was the passion, of the company, and to beat IBM. I mean, I remember thinking at the time, how are you guys going to beat IBM? I mean, well, there was I think I was number 1600 that was hired at Apple Computer. And at the time there was 2,500 of us. And IBM was thousands and thousands of people and money. And at that time too, IBM, if they said something, everybody topped too. You were always at the effect of IBM. FUD, remember? Fear, uncertainty, and doubt. That was their marketing plan. It worked very well. And that's how they marketed their stuff, and you had to step up and bound and do it their way. And Steve just came out, and I don't know if you remember one of his little commercials where he had a little binder that was a little tiny book and said, this is how you use a Mac. And then he had five huge manuals and this is how you use an IBM, and just, the whole thing. And it was all about empowering people. And I remember one trade show I worked at when I was at Apple, and somebody came up to me, and I think that they were either deaf, they were handicapped in some way, and they said, thank you for the computer. For the first time, I'm able to keep up. I'm able to compete. I'm able to be a part of. And, that impacted me forever, right? It's like, oh my gosh, this is what we're doing here. We're empowering everyone. So it was like I said, a very, very amazing time. The parties were amazing too at Apple. Yeah, I'm just kind of thinking back now about taking the bus and going to the mansion, and they hired the Addams Family actors. And they ran all around the mansion and fed us, and Lurch answered the door. And I mean, just creative things like that. Pointer Sisters, I got to see the Pointer Sisters. Robin Williams showed up and told Macintosh jokes.
Now that you see that's power in the world, isn't it? To get the best comedian in the world telling jokes about your product. I mean, well,
Oh my God! And this was back when he was doing Nanu Nanu, right? So what did he say? McBucks, McWozniak. Oh, McJobs, McBucks, and McWozniak. And from then on, it was McEverything. When we were at Apple, McHappy, McSad, McCrazy, everything had an MC before it because of what Robin Williams did. People threw T-shirts at him. He was very, very funny. He had picked up the essence and the culture of the company so fast that by the time he got in this tent and did the stand-up routine for us, he was brilliant. He's an amazing comedian, which... But anyway, to have him just show up, yeah, sure, I'll be there. Okay. Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Wow. So you know, it was these were what they called heady days, you know, hedonistic, enjoyable, creative. And yeah. they took a different approach. They took a different approach to graphics. They made their own chips. They didn't use chips from adding machines. Well, actually, what did the chips come from? What did they build? They didn't build their own chip. They started with a processor somehow, as you do.
They did, but I thought they had their own. You know, offhand, if I gave you information on that, I'd be wrong. I know that I worked for Walt, who designed his own motherboard. And I think at one time we actually had a manufacturing place in San Jose area, Fremont, and it was absolutely breathtakingly beautiful, but it was non-affordable. And I think they made the motherboards there. I'm not sure where they got the chips. And then they send it to Ireland. I think they send it to Texas for a while, and then they send it to Ireland, and Ireland ended up doing our computers. So it could be we had our own chip, probably. Right. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, you see, yeah, chips is a level of clean room technology and microprocessor, right, and extremely expensive. And you know, in general, they start off with well, you know, industrial processors. These ones, most of the time you've got a computer, it's an industrial processor that is used to control the robot arms on a big machine, like maybe a big 3D type printer. I actually had a bit of experience with one. And you can buy them in the shops for 40 quid now. What's that in dollars? About $60. Buys you a thing called an Arduino, and you can write your own programs and download it from your Apple phone or from your Android phone, and create a program to make this thing, and you can make it turn on lights or do whatever you like. And so you can do what these guys did in their background. You can come up with your own operating system if you wanted to. And then upload it to the web, and other people can buy the little boxes and download your operating system, and there you go. You can be the next generation of what Apple did in the 1970s. Meanwhile, we got, is it, no, it was in the 80s or the 70s? I started in the 70s with IBM things.
Oh, okay. Where? And by the way, they were 6502 or 65C02 running at 1.023 megahertz. So I think they were their own chips. That was the microprocessor, the 6502.
Yeah, yeah. So that
for Apple IIe.
That's the processor. That's the mm-hmm. The brain. But you build the motherboard around the brain to do the different functions and to be able to program it and talk to it and make it do graphics and things like that. So
yeah,
I mean, a computer is, in a way, it's not really rocket science. It's more like plumbing, but in very fine electrical thin wires, and you're not using water. Anyway, but you know, you still have to solder the copper pipes together. Isn't it interesting? You know, same as plumbing. Electronics and plumbing is very similar, and it follows the same rules. And you still use the same tools to weld the pieces together. Copper and solder. Interesting,
isn't it? Yeah.
Sorry, I just went off that. Anyway, meanwhile.
No, and I want to add something here too, that I was sad when Steve Jobs kind of got away from manufacturing, because I don't think it's well known that one of his passions, one of the things he was brilliant at, was manufacturing. He spent an inordinate amount of time going to Japan, because they were the premier manufacturers at the time, right? That they know how to do it economically, ergonomically, blah, 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 blah. So he went there. He learned how to do it. The Macintosh factory was absolutely flawless. It was beautiful. But he just couldn't. They just felt like, sorry, this just is not economical to do it in California. But he's just so brilliant at it. And I was always disappointed he gave it up. He just got it. He just was so good at it. Anyway, I'd throw that in there. Besides all the other things he was really good at, but he was really, really good at that.
Yeah, I mean, he had all these different skills, which As I said in the last conversation we had, that I heard he fell into these things. He was bored with this irrelevant course he was on, so he quit it and wandered around the campus and eventually found himself at the calligraphy classes, and he took the classes and learned how to do the kerning and the fonts and all the leading and all these little things to do typesetting. And then that was what made the Apple so useful and so unique to the printing industry, to the music industry, because you need the printing, to the eventually the newspaper and publishing industries all over the world. So that little, you know, mistake, so-called, that, you know, he felt that he failed it. He was just wandering around. And it's those moments when you feel disillusioned, when you have no illusions, when you just take the world, you just wonder, you just allow the world to impinge on you and see what happens. Those are the opportunities that the gods and angels can get to us and give us messages for the future.
I think you're right. I think, and I think those are also scary times, because you have to be silent, you have to be patient, and it doesn't always come the way you want it to. Sometimes it comes in little whispers, right? Yeah, and our lives take a lot of different turns.
Yeah, so it's interesting, you know, that I feel like, you know, these little games where you have a ball bearing that is kind of bouncing around between nails, and it just feels like this is how we're expressing through time. It's like dropping like little steel ball bearings bouncing through these nails, bouncing off these nails as we drop through time. I wonder how long it's going to go on for. It just goes on forever, just bouncing around. But anyway, meanwhile, so Steve Jobs is falling into calligraphy, and then he's, like you said, he's got these manufacturing skills. He's got this mind that can take thought and create form. And that is what the Apple is used for. Now, I have to say, I've got a couple of Apples. I don't use them all the time, because a lot of what my work is writing programs for adding machines. And I've been doing that forever. You know, I can still program a cash register. All of these little weird things, that, you know, weird little devices that I've had to deal with all through my career. But he created a device that reflected his process, which is to start something and it manifests, you know. So you can easily create something on a Mac that then manifests as a real thing, say a 3D printed item.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, his name was Jobs, because he certainly put a lot of people to work. You know, it's there's something in a name, isn't there? And I think that he certainly lived by that word, Steve Jobs. He was a very complicated person. I don't think he was a simple person, although he was single-minded. I think he knew what he wanted. And I know, as you said, he fell into some things, which I think he probably did. One of the next computer was also, I don't know if you ever got your hands on that thing. That was an amazing computer. I got to play with one once. I just loved it. It was all black. And there was something amazing, because that was completely different than the Mac, right? The Mac was cream-colored and square and clunky and all this stuff. And then he had the next, and the next was this black, sleek, like a spaceship, you know? It was the difference, the difference between a schoolroom and a spaceship.
Yeah, exactly.
It was really amazing, and I think he that was not a super success, certainly not like he wanted it to be, and he went off to go do Pixar, I guess, too. So that started something. And then if you remember, he comes back to Apple sort of as an advisor. Do you remember that whole little thing he did?
Yeah, so what was all that about? Because he fell out, or yeah, what he left. What? And this is another part of his story. He says, you know, like, did he leave or did he fall or was he pushed? What's the what was the story behind Steve Jobs going and then coming back? I mean, you want to bring that arc together.
I really think that Scully never understood computers like Steve did. He didn't understand innovation. He wasn't an innovator. He didn't have his finger on the pulse like Steve Jobs did. But Steve was too young to run the company when he was at Macintosh. And I think they weren't quite ready for him. I think he had the ideas, but he was like a little young. I think if you go back to that time zone, Wall Street mattered, selling stock, stockholders, yada, yada, yada. So he leaves in 1984, right? And Scully takes over and does okay, but never really takes it to where Steve would have taken it, I think. And then I believe that Scully kind of was behind getting rid of Steve Jobs. He kind of knifed him in the back, and the whole company knew. And Scully actually wrote a book about his, you know, tenure at Apple, and everybody got a book. I remember I was working there at the time. I think I'd gone back as a contractor, and they gave me a book, and I threw it in the trash and left it at the desk. I'm like, I'm not reading this. I know your story. I know what you did. So I'm not sure exactly about all the little ins and outs, and I'm just kind of looking at the history. In 1996, Apple announced that it would buy Next. So they bought the computer, but I'm trying to remember when he went back. But I do remember that he went in to do some advising. If you remember, they had some bumbling CEOs, and that one just got worse than the other and worse than the other and worse than the other. And then I think the stock actually went down to, what, 30s or 40s or something. So Steve went back, quote-unquote, as an advisor. And that's when things started to turn around. And I knew it was, it's kind of like watching Putin, actually. Steve was ready. He had grown up. He had had some failures, some successes. He had Pixar, which was a major success. And when he came back, he was ready. It's like, I know how to play this game. What you guys did to me last time isn't going to happen again. I'm coming back. And everybody was really excited, and that's what happened. So I'm not sure of the exact time zones. But like I said, I was never a fan of Scully, I'm afraid. I just felt like he was your typical, what we might consider Wall Street banker types, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we talk about these people. Yeah, we talk about these people on the radio quite a lot. He sounds like the absolute powers that be plant designed to hold the progress back, designed to restrict. It was very interesting the way you described him, that he would not have been the kind of person that would fit in with those junkets that you were talking about earlier, where the minds were flowing and the ideas, and it was so flowing and enjoyable, that he would have been like a rock in that flow, like a rock in the water.
Yeah, and I just looked up the time zone. So 1996, Apple bought Next, and they ousted Gil Amelio. Remember that? Does that vaguely kind of, that name, Gil Amelio? Jobs becomes a de facto chief after then CEO Gil Amelio, who was ousted in 1997. And then he started turning it around. That was the beginning of the big change. And I knew once he came back, just my little sense of Steve Jobs. Like I said, I wasn't a friend. I talked to him only a couple of times there. But just my sense of him, that the guy didn't mess around. He had a purpose, you know?
Yeah.
So that's when things changed. He came back. It's like, ruh-roh. He made some changes, but you know, I mean to go back, can you imagine actually getting a second chance, a second shot at something, and then really being successful at it? What an amazing gift that would be too.
Well, you know, again, this is Steve Jobs is an example of destiny working out as it does, because it always seems like an accident. You always seem like you're falling out into it. But it, like I said, it's like these little ball bearings falling down there's no way you can avoid destiny because it's below you. And that's the way we're going, you know. We're descending like a waterfall. So, through time and space. Anyway, no. But that's the inevitability of it. You know, time's not going to stop. Something, you know, cycles are going to move around. But let's focus back on the silicon consciousness. So, and then there was this other. There's these other developments, because one of the things that you may have had, you know, local area networks. You had that. What's that Apple Wire thing? No, was it not Apple Talk? Because I remember these. My experience. You see, because what I've been doing in over the years is I repair things that businesses use, and hospitals and I would come across Apple equipment, and then I'd see all these plugs, and like this like multitude of tiny little pins in this round plug that was like, the WTF moment almost every time I saw an Apple Mac product. And then the other thing is that that because they work on it, they have a completely different architecture, they work differently. I couldn't repair them, and I couldn't program them, and so I've had this kind of long distance relationship with Macs. The interesting thing recently is though that the Mac operating system is now working on the same operating system as Linux and other web servers and things like that. So there's a Unix based system on there. So there's been a convergence. And all, as we say, with the original point and click iconized interface was not Mac, it wasn't PC, it was a Xerox idea, X Windows. Remember them talking about that in the 80s when I was working in the university. Because then I was typing characters into a terminal, and it would send characters back to me. And I'd then have to decode what the characters meant. And, that was what computing was in those days. They didn't talk to you.
Right.
Yet we saw these talking computers in Star Trek, somebody had it. Somebody had it somewhere. So here's the thing. A lot of what I talk about on the show is what people could class as paranormal. Now, your descriptions and histories so far have been what would be, normal. But these ideas, were people, what were they on? Were they doing mescalito? Were they taking peyote, cactus, ayahuasca? Were there extraterrestrials involved? This is the kind of nitty gritty stuff we like to get down to on Ever Beyond.
That's funny. So let's talk about that a little bit. So, if you're creating something that hasn't existed before, aren't you really kind of going somewhere that you haven't been before? Let's go back to Anita's get-together, right, where everybody's synapses is firing out of the top of their head, and all of a sudden you've got these ideas. Now, when I first started at Apple, they were talking about why would women have a computer except for recipes, and I don't mean that in a sexist way, but nobody could figure it out. My parents said, well, what would I do with a computer, right? All that stuff. And, you talk about the ball bearings and, falling through the... It's like we pulled ideas out of the universe. It's like everything would come to us while we were on the run. And I know Steve Jobs, didn't he go off somewhere for a while and do meditation for a year or two and kind of get in touch with his inner self? Now, switching over to Silicon Graphics, I will tell you that the CEO over there, he did do meditation. He was well known for that. And Silicon Graphics was a wonderful place to work while he was there. Ed McCracken. Ed McCracken was, and his family was into meditation. But when you think about how you get a bunch of engineers, now you're techie enough to know what I'm saying. So you get a bunch of engineers that pound on a keyboard and work on software and make it do magical stuff. Where does that come from? Are you, you know, besides ho-hos and Twinkies?
Well, actually, most of the time it is. this is programmer food. Real poker.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I
think, you know, when you get a team of people together and say, okay, we're here, we need to be over there. It has to do these five things. Go do it. How does that happen? You know, some of it is I learned how to program in school, but a lot of it is, I don't know. I'm going to pound on the keyboard. I'm going to heat ho-hos. I'm going to work 24 hours a day to make it happen, and then it's going to happen. But you engineer folks, to me, are the magicians. You tell me what you do. I'm just the project manager that makes sure it gets to that end of the place at the right time and you don't fall off the cliff. That's my job. That you don't fall off the cliff. You have enough ho-hos and Twinkies, but you've got to be over there by June. You know, that's kind of mysterious in a way to me. I've always admired engineers because to me they go into this mystical place in their heads and they kind of throw things together and it works. Ta-da! I don't mean to be obtuse about it, but I mean, you know, that was my experience. I mean, going back to the freedom, let me explain. I think when I say that, I mean that you have to have that to create something magical. There has to be a certain amount of freedom. Doing something in a box, doing something like the IBM way or the Microsoft way, to me would just be drudgery and pain. But to be able to be in an environment where there is a certain amount of freedom, and hey, look, we don't care how you get there, we just want you to be able to do these five things when you plug in the software. When you load that into your system, it can do these five things, make it happen. But it has to, but you know, I don't know. That's, but was there a lot of, you're asking if there's lots of drugs and stuff like that? No. I think though, I will say the kind of people that gravitated to an Apple or Silicon Graphics were the kind of people that could come on the show right now and talk to you about all this and feel very comfortable. People comfortable outside their skin or outside the box. That didn't bother them. In fact, being in a box was bothersome.
Well, interestingly, another show that I run with Katie Galanti on Alternate Sundays is indeed called Out of the Box. And it's an interesting thing. Are there any computer companies that use non-linear architecture, i.e. round rooms, octagonal rooms, different geometric forms than the normal cube? I know that's a really obtuse question, but if you've been into all these companies, which ones had really comfortable buildings? You were saying that Apple had this mysterious energy to it, like a pyramid, like they had a pyramid inside it. Well, they had Steve Jobs, and he was emanating energy, you know.
Well, I mean, so I can speak for that time. Let me put a couple thoughts together. Okay, so let's talk about that time, and then we'll talk about this time, okay, that I see free form in a way. So in that time, you would know you were in a fun environment because you didn't have to wear a suit if you were a guy. If you were an engineer, you didn't have to wear a suit. You were a god. They did feed you. There were colors on the wall. There were the buildings were done fun. At Apple, you had lots of colors and things and T-shirts and giveaways and freebies and bean bag chairs and foosball and all that kind of stuff. And that was a big thing then because most of us came from an environment of 9 to 5, wear a suit, act right, talk correctly, no T-shirts, no jeans, no, you know, nothing like that.
Shave,
right?
And makeup, you know, whatever.
You were a 9 to 5er, right? Okay.
You see, luckily, I never had much of that. I don't like
okay.
it. Yeah. I was in the university, but, so we were hippies. So, but anyway, do go on. It had that creative informality that
exactly,
I enjoyed
and I think in that kind of an environment, you can be more creative. I think because that's kind of what it's about, right? You work the hours you wanted to work for the most part. Some people were early risers, late risers, and some people spent. I actually went in a couple times at El Silicon Graphics. Some people were asleep under their desk. You'd actually spent the night there.
And that's so, what we called hacking.
Yes.
In those days, that was hacking. This
yes,
is proper
all-nighters.
Hacking. Yeah, the going all night and, again, living on Twinkies and coffee and
pretty
speaking
much.
In uppercase.
Yes, yes, okay. Exactly, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you look at the, I call it the Kool-Aid drinking companies now, I don't know if they're fun or not. I don't even know if people get to have this kind of freedom anymore, to be honest with you. I really don't know if it exists in this time zone. That's an interesting question you bring up. I question that. But to entice the young ones right now, the 20, 30-somethings, if you go to these websites, name any of the new companies like Google, like Twitter, like Facebook, they're all around here. You have YouTubes. The YouTubes say, oh, and this is us having fun, and this is us being at the park, and this is us giving at the food bank, and this is us, and this is us, and this is the culture, and when you're here, it's so much fun to be here. And so you have YouTubes. And I call it the Kool-Aid drinking YouTubes. It's like, and you'll drink this Kool-Aid. They do have fun environments. They do have no cubes now. Pretty much it's the open office concept, which means there's no cubes and you're all talking and working together. I've seen one where they're all just sitting in a big line and they all have big smiles on their faces having a good time. Does that appeal to people in their 20s and 30s? I guess so. I guess it does. And do they feel like they're free? Maybe they do. At this point, I guess I'm older and thinking that doesn't look like fun to me, but I don't know.
Well, you know.
That's not my idea of a fun time. But that's okay. It doesn't matter. But that's how they're selling it. Are we really free to create right now, or are we all sort of on this walk?
Well, Sharon.
Yes.
Let's take a break.
Okay, yes.
I'm going to play a band 07. Have you 07 heard of 07?
I'm sure I will enjoy it.
Really nice music. Really cool. This is okay. Called Destiny by 07.
Okay, that sounds great.
Welcome to Ever Beyond. Beyond. Welcome back. Oh, no, don't do that. Oh, dear, don't. Hang on a second. Stop that. Oh, that's good. Phew. All right. I just thought that the machine was just going to stop the recorders, and that would have been really disastrous. Anyway, or slightly disastrous, a real pain in the neck. But anyway, everything's fine, and that's the one that I wanted it to play, not this one. Right, okay, let's just do that. That's the one. Right. There we are. Ever Beyond on Wolf Spirit Radio, No Borders Radio, and everbeyond.radio.com. We are back. We're talking with Sharon Barrington, our correspondent from Silicon Valley, home of the greater consciousness of the planet, or so they think.
I love it. I love the way you put that. That's fantastic.
Well, you know, I've just been watching a TV show called Eureka, which has the plot is that it was the people who ran the Manhattan Project that created the atomic bomb just didn't stop. You know, they kept doing things and they became the most inventive place. And it was a place they called Eureka because it was Einstein's dream of having a place where the greatest minds in the world could live and develop and create. And this is the place in the early 21st century, having started 60 years ago. So it's a little town, and you know, people have levitating craft, and everything's computerized. And, you know, it's an ahead civilization, and in a way, the control processes for those civilizations were also shared by those in Silicon Valley. You know, there is a military-industrial complex aspect to that. You know, the same controllers that are going into the jet aircraft and the tanks and the other weapons, those are getting the spin-off and going into the domestic market as personal computers.
Well, yeah, that's a big part of this, right? You've got Moffett Field, you've got DARPA, you've got Stanford, Berkeley, you've got all these big universities here, you've got all this money, tons of money, lots of things going on. In fact, there's, let me see if I can find this. Yesterday, I saw there was an article on a chip in your head. Okay, let me find the name of it.
The only chips in my head want to be made of potato and fried in deep fat.
Yes, but this is it's the future of brain implants. Now, one of the things I did fast-forwarding into the early 2000s was, which I think I mentioned on your show, I belonged to the Futures. I joined the Futures group, and I joined the Nanotechnology group. And that was, I think, 2001, 2002, 2003. I did it for 3 years. And it's just something I like to do just because it was fun. So one of the lectures I attended, which was, all of this is free, all, you know, they're always doing talks here, come here, listen to this. You know, maybe it's $20, maybe it's $100, maybe it's free. But this was from a guy over at Stanford. I wish I could remember his name. But he was talking about developing a chip for your brain. And it would make you happy. And me being the pain in the neck. So the more he talked, the more angry I got, because he kept talking about how you could be happy every single day and never have any more worries, because he called it the happy chip. And I kept thinking about things like, what about your soul? What about all those brilliant writers or alcoholics? Because he said you wouldn't be an alcoholic anymore. So long story short, I wait for the lecture to be over. I go up and I'm frothing. I'm so mad. It's like, because they're also talking about having to compete. So let's say you choose a chip in your brain. You can think faster than me. You're smarter than me. Would they give you a job over me? Would you be more hireable over me? Probably. So anyway, I go up to him and I said, what about your soul? What about all those brilliant alcoholic writers? You know, what about Poe? What about Hemingway? They're all drinkers. He's just like, okay, thanks for sharing. You know, so the thing that disturbs me a lot about some of the stuff they're doing is obviously, and I think we talked about this on the other show on Monday, was the humanness is being sort of deleted, right? They don't think about souls. That's not something that they worry about. Some of the people I met in the nano group have $100,000 that they've donated to this cryogenic company who's going to cryogenically freeze them so that they can come back in 100 years. I still don't know how that works, but they'll come back. And I said to them, what about your soul? And they said, well, we don't believe in those, so it's okay. Now, soul to me means the energy that fuels your human body. So whatever word you'd like to use for that. But from my perspective, having been at some people their deathbeds, when your body decides that it's had its time here, whatever essence was in you is gone. I don't know how you cryogenically freeze that. But, you know. But anyway, that's kind of what's going on now. And I think we're all starting to see that they're developing all this stuff to sort of delete the humanness of us, you know. In some ways it's good. Perhaps people who are deaf can hear. Maybe the blind can see, which I have, you know, that would be fantastic. I would love to see them do things so that people who have broken backs or spines can walk again, broken legs, you know, things like that. If you lose your arm or your leg, that they have prosthetics that are so amazing that you won't notice it, you know. That's all fabulous. But it distresses me to see the humanness be sort of deleted bit by bit. So it's kind of interesting.
That's, you know, we have a TV series here called Doctor Who.
Yes.
And one of the dreaded villains of Doctor Who were the Cybermen, who were basically augmented humans in armor suits. And, well, basically it was the brain of the human in this metal body. And they believed that they were superior, and they would upgrade people without asking. And it really is like, really is like Microsoft, you know.
yes,
they're scary. Similar. They're really scary because they, you know, they have no compassion for your humanity. They believe that your humanity is a flawed situation, and that that they are the solution to our flaws. And that's kind of scary. That I'd, you know, it's nice to be perfect. Perfect is really cool, but not everybody has to be that cool and that perfect. Why does everybody have to be perfect? Sounds like Nazi world to me. Maybe we're already in Nazi world.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I, you know, things are happening so quickly, but I think part of my fascination in horror has been at all of the things that they intend to do with this, you know, and the fact that part of this future tech was also trying to get along with the people who were questioning them without being called a Luddite, you know, and a Luddite is someone who they consider, you know, being willing to stay in the technology of yesteryear. But, you know, we're not even being asked. I think that's obviously, well, obviously we're not being asked about anything, but I mean, we're not being asked about, do we want these chips? Do we want our medication to have sensors in them, which I was going to talk a little bit about today? Do we want our soul to disappear? Do we want to be happy every day? What's so good about being happy? You know, I mean, sometimes I think out of all of the tragedy in our lives comes something brilliant, like a book, like a movie, like a story that can help our other fellow humans on the planet. Isn't that part of all that stuff that's being here? And the other part of the chip in your brain is how much can they manipulate it? You know, what if they've got these little flying drones now that have remote control, or they can turn them off? You know, I just, the whole thing is just, it's sort of very sci-fi horror. You know, it's like our Star Trek Borg, right? The same thing.
Exactly. I mean, it is, you know, that these ideas didn't come from nowhere. You know, they existed.
No.
And, you know, the idea of Darth Vader is a very ancient scripture, you know, from called the Vedas, in fact. You know, giving a nod to what it's called. There were books called the Vedas where there was a character like Darth Vader, and his name was Anu, and there's all these stories about them and how much, you know. And they've had robots, and there are artificial intelligences out there, and, you know, we're just developing our own. And it's like the Apple machine is the product of the mind of Steve Jobs. Computers in general, in the way we have them, are the output of humanity.
Yes, and I think the internet is a wonderful. If, you know, I know that President Obama has signed over what some of the pieces of the internet to the UN this week, and another one of his pen and telephone entries. But the internet to me is such a blessing because, oh my God, I'm talking to you clear across the other side of the world. That's amazing.
That's right. I mean, you know, like you and I, we've both had all this experience, and I'm sure that you still experience a sense of awe at even this, you know, and because when we were children, this was what was portrayed as this is what the future's like. You know, we speak to people from the moon. We saw 2001, and they have essentially a Skype conversation on a television screen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a Skype conversation, and in 2001, we had video Skype, you know.
Yeah.
So all these things are completely possible.
Right. I mean, we've got all of the stuff. If you look, go back to Star Trek One, right, with the original, you had the tricorder and you had Beam Me Up Scotty, which I think they've actually talked that they do have that now. You've got microwave ovens. You've got spaceships. And I still think we have technology that they're not telling us they have. And they're going places and doing things that they're not telling us about. You know, I kind of wonder, when going back to the Borg, if their big fear is that's what's coming and they're trying to save themselves. Because that's basically the big message, is that they're trying to save themselves from something that's coming. This off-world, this breakaway civilization. You know, it's kind of interesting.
Well, this is the gist of the Sands of Time. That's what the Sands of Time is about. And it was because of the rips in space-time that was created in the 30s with the Nazi Bell experiments and the Philadelphia experiments. They were too heavy-handed, I believe, that they cranked the thing up far too much and they tore something. You know, because they're typical military, and like they turn things up to 10 before they, you know, most people start at 1. You know, anyway, so this is the problem, and that's, you know, that they could see them coming, and we've got remote viewers that are looking at the coming, all that stuff. But according to the Sands of Time, they first invented time travel and teleportation technology. And laser technology, and that's how the defense grid works. They actually teleport a gas laser that can cut through a planet. They can teleport them from their labs out into space where the defense grid needs to be put, fire off, and then teleport them back to the lab.
Isn't that amazing? They can terraform planets with that laser too.
Yeah.
I went to they actually have SETI talks here, you know, the group that's looking for the extraterrestrials. I don't mean that so sarcastically. What I said to one of the people working there the other day is, I said, if you actually found them, when they let you announce it. But anyway, they have free talks here every week. And one of them was talking about lasers, and that they can terraform. They have the technology now. They can terraform planets, and they can do so many other things with this thing. It's just amazing. It's amazing.
I think that some crop circles were made by this technology from space. A space platform.
Yeah.
A little like a pen, you know. And boom, it's like a chymoglyph, like the sound forms like they have it's kinematics. Have you heard of kinematics? Cymatics? The shape made by sound.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Okay, I think I've heard of that. Yeah.
So the form is a chymoglyph, and that's what crop circles can be. That their movement in sound.
It's like that book. I can't remember the name of it. Yeah, it was The Best of Times, It Was the Worst of Times. What's the name of that book that starts out with that? Tale of Two Cities? Tale of Two Cities,
yeah.
I think.
Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah, Best of Times, It Was the Worst of Times. And if you go through that whole first page, it's amazing. It's all those. And that's where we are, right? It's like the best of times. It's like the worst of times. I think we're going to be seeing all kinds of inventions and amazing things coming our way. And then we're going to be seeing some things we may wish we didn't get to see.
Yeah, because we need these fantastic toys, but we don't know what we need to assemble them into yet. But I think that essentially, we'll get through it. I think.
Probably, hopefully.
Mostly.
I like that, just.
But yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know.
Don't you figure other civilizations have been here before? I do.
Oh, must. I think
this is a necessary part of it.
Yeah, it's part of the galactic process. And we're going through an energy rise that is coming up, you know, in the last couple of days. I don't know if you've experienced anything to do with your stomach. at all. Any stomach aches or fluttery feelings or any other things like heightened aggression or emotionality or anything like that. It rises and it falls again. It rises and it falls again. Each time gets more and more intense. But when it rises, it causes a clearing to happen. And, you know, stuff, emotional clearing, stuff comes out. You have arguments, you have fights, you know, things get broken. But they get cleared. They're coming up to be cleared. I believe that this is part of the galactic wave situation. And eventually the sun's going to do the same thing. It's going to go, fadoom. And, you know, it could be in a couple of weeks' time. Everybody's feeling something's going to be happening soon.
You know what I find interesting about this moment in time, you know, just even focusing on what's happening with Putin and Obama and those guys, is that they're not hiding anymore. There's nothing hidden. You know, we don't know where it is, but they didn't hide that it got hijacked. I mean, they tried, but not that hard. The whole thing, all the stuff that's going on, the banking, the economy, all of it, it's all kind of coming to light now. You know, it's all kind of coming to the surface. And I think the people that need to pay attention to it are seeing it for what it is, which is an amazing miracle to me, because, you know, you think if you go back to all those years we were talking about, we were still trying to struggle to find out what was going on in the planet. You know, I was listening to Art Bell to find out what was going on in the planet. He was like the only voice in town for a long time. Now, it's like with all of Twitter and millisecond news and all alternative, we know when they're lying and we can call them on it. And that may be the power. We may not be able to stop them in their tracks, but at least we can call them on their lies. And just go, yeah, right, whatever. You know, Obama's still trying to sell Obamacare. And it's failing. It's flailing. No one's buying it. They're physically not buying it. Even though the IRS is going to come after us and tax us, we don't want it. We're not interested. It's a piece of, you know, junk. So I find that must be significant somehow, somewhere. So that's a positive thing from my perspective.
Yeah, well, this is the awakening process as it happens, you know, we've been waiting for it. We know it's coming. We've been preparing for it. Everybody who's a certain kind of... And it's interesting because I'm looking in the chat room. There's Trem, Tremjar, and he's saying that, you know, this is College Plus. Yeah, in the alternative community, this little campfire that we're all sitting around, this little living room we're in, is a... It's high grade stuff, you know. Not everybody can take the kind of stuff that we talk about here, because it can be quite intense. But this is incredibly interesting. It's a part of the puzzle, and certainly the this area of the world that you're in and its product affects the world. You know, when America sneezes, the world gets a cold. When Silicon Valley sneezes, the world dies of pneumonia, you know.
There is some very significant things going on here. I would definitely say that's true. And it still amazes me that I can run around at any one time and just kind of go to all these different things. And I sit there thinking, wow, I have there are 50 people in this room and listening to what I'm hearing. Can you imagine? And I say to myself, can you imagine this? Can you imagine you're listening to this? This is amazing. It's still amazing to me. You know, like a new idea or a new product or oh no, did you guys know we're going this way? You know, because they're talking about the future. You know, it's like, well, no, we think it's going to end up here. Wow, yeah, that makes sense. You know, it was like hot before it's off the presses. You know, So maybe I'm spoiled. You know, you asked me a question before, do we smoke the funny stuff and how do we... But maybe it's because when you're here, it's expected you think outside the box. You are outside the box. You know, it's fun, it's exciting, but it's expected. It's like, well, what did you do today? You know, and maybe that's part of the drug is just the thrill of it, you know, to come up with some ideas.
High on the mind. Excellent. So.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I wanted to throw something out here that I kind of put together before the show that I had not seen. I just want to throw this out there for your perusal, for your thinking. I have stayed away from the plane thing very much, you know, because I think it's a big distraction. I think it did get taken. If there were people on the plane, I hope, you know, the spirit's with them. You know, I feel very sad about them and the family. But I think it has been such a distraction. But one of the things that's been interesting about the whole thing is the whole scale. Is it Freescale Semiconductor?
Yeah, these the people who were aboard
the
just
patents,
happened all
yeah.
to... Yeah, and the patents, and who's a patent lawyer, and I bet Hillary... Yeah, anyway, go on.
Well, I just wanted to throw this out there because I was putting this together in this... to Google, because, you know, we talked about Google and Steve Jobs. And this kind of came together. And so Dr. Regina Dugan is the woman that I think I mentioned. I didn't remember her name last time.
She's
but
the DARPA lady, isn't she?
She's DARPA, yes. She was the first female DARPA director. And she's talking about us eating authentication chips. Okay, right? We eat those, and they have the sensors in them. And the name of the company that I was talking about last time, I said Prometheus, it's Proteus.
Proteus.
So Proteus is now selling, you can sign up to have a sensor in your medication. The sensor information goes to your patch on your arm. And then that information goes to your cell phone. And it goes to a secure location, right? On so you're in an account on your cell phone, which is probably in the cloud somewhere, okay? The doctor can tell when you're taking your medication, if you're moving around, and your heart rate and things like that. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, so it's the GPS. That's probably a Bluetooth connection to the
yes.
mobile. And
yeah, it
like
is Bluetooth,
so
yeah.
So it would be all the technologies that we're used to all being put together in a specific way. It's like
yes.
it's like one of these guns that is like a cake slice. You know, it's like you unscrew the things and it becomes a gun. And this is how they can weaponize our devices. You know, but anyway, so you've got there's a Proteus company and
their product is called Helios.
Helios. Oh, like
the sun. Yes. Now, I'm going to put this in your chat room. And anyway, so Helios is the product. So let's say you and I have to take a medication, and we contact these guys, and they'll put it in our medication, and we go see Dr. Brown 2 weeks later. So, Sharon, I see that you're not moving around a lot. I need you to move more, you know, stuff like that. I'm going to send also where you can see the YouTube. There's a little YouTube, and it's just so sweetly done where there's a mom and a daughter. To worry about the mom because now the doctor can see that the mom's not moving or she's taking her pill or blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, so Dr. Regina Dugan also has a YouTube. Have you seen her YouTube where she talks about taking the authentication chip?
Oh, sorry.
Did I
nearly spat my tea.
For you?
It's a good thing that's a very expensive microphone. I just swallowed just before you said that. Take the authentication chip. Oh, my God. That sounds like, you know, it just sounds so welcome to Nazi Earth. You have to come here and we have to implant this thing into your brain or somewhere that will be unpleasant. Just for a moment. Just a little pinprick.
Call her the DARPA princess, and that's a little harsh. But basically, I heard about the sensor through her YouTube, and now, lo and behold, there is a company here that sells the technology, so you too can have that. So I put the couple things in the chat room. Okay, now, what's interesting about this, now here's where I'm going to throw this together, where it comes together with the airplane, because I just figured this out this afternoon. It's like, okay, so long story short, before she worked at Google, she worked at a Skunk Works project at Motorola. Motorola is Freescale. Okay, or, yeah, and... So Google sold the Motorola Mobility to Lenovo, which is a Chinese company, but not her part. So she went over to Google. Now, fast forward to this airplane gig, right? And who's sitting on the airplane but 20 Freescale employees? I just thought that was interesting.
Well,
and by the way, Motorola produced the first sensor chip.
Yeah,
long ago.
This sounds like it's echoing the biochemist's cull of the 90s, just before all of these diseases came out. A whole load of biochemists who could have said, hang on, this is a load of BS, were all suddenly deaded. Loads of them. It was like
like 100 or 200 or 300 or thousands. It's pretty bad.
So what we're looking at now is that they're trying to deploy this stuff, and they have to kill all the experts, or not necessarily that they were killed. There may have been other factors involved. This may have been more of a battle than first appears. That there may there's an idea that it was taken aboard a ship. You know. Beamed up and rescued, as it were, because it could have gone another way.
Well, I just thought it was an interesting kind of connection. Our little DARPA princess used to be over there with Motorola and Freescale, and she's not the person who went over to Lenovo. That's interesting. And by the way, that's now owned by the Rothschilds, which is Blackstone. The Rothschilds own that patent. You know, where the patent ended up, is it Pidong Wang had 20% of the patent, Zi Junchen, Zi Hongchen, Li Yung, and then Freescale Semiconductor had 20. So it had been divided into five parts. And I guess Blackstone, I think that's their name, that is Rothschild. So they own the patents, and it's sitting over in Austin, Texas, which is also connected to the Carlyle Group, which is Daddy Bush.
And Dick Cheney.
Our good friends over there.
Oh, I try to forget their names. Rumsfeld.
It's good.
Donald Rumsfeld, yes. Oh.
And Condi Rice. Miss Shoes. So... I was putting the notes together today for the show, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is so interesting. She's a very interesting lady. The YouTube is 8 minutes. It's very telling. The patch to me reminds me of the people from Auschwitz, you know, the people that were in the concentration camps, because there's a number on this patch. And it's on your wrist. And she talks about it like, oh, yeah, the kids would really love to have a patch. And he said, well, I think at one point he says, oh, do they come in different designs? Oh, yes, we can manage that. Anyway, so she's over at Google, and our buddies at Google are busy, you know, redesigning our planet. So you're right. That's kind of where we're going. So it's very, very interesting. I have no feeling about the plane. I have no idea where it is. I don't know anything. I just saw this particular connection. So, but I do feel it's going to be very interesting with all the digital health stuff. You know, a lot of it's wearables. It's all sensors, right? So there's a new one out where you put it on and it'll talk to you. You're not running the right way. Slow down. Your heartbeat needs to speed up. So we've got all these things telling us how to run our health better and do things. One of my colleagues is on some kind of regime where he has his information in the cloud as well. And I said, well, aren't you worried about that getting broken into? No, I'm not worried about it. It's like, oh, yeah, it's so secure. But that's nothing like eating them. I mean, I think my big concern is, where do these sensors go? Supposedly your stomach acid eats them, right? But how do we know that? So anyway, those are
how do we know that when they hit stomach acid, they morph into little crawling bots with little drills on them that drill their way through your stomach and find their way into your brain? How do we know that?
That's
like a
my
worm.
Point.
You know, exactly.
Exactly. And that is exactly what they have been working on with the nano, is that you have a smart nano bot that can go into like cancer cells and eat the cancer. They've been working on this for a very long time. So, yeah. Where do these sensors go? Because someone was talking to me, oh, yeah, because he went to the talk. I didn't realize that they were giving a talk. I definitely would have gone. But they were there a couple weeks ago, and they gave each one of these guys a little sensor. See, it's harmless. So I said to him, well, what are you going to do when you have five of these? Because they didn't quite go where they were supposed to go when you swallowed them. And then where do they end up in the water, right? So now they end up in the wastewater. Now you have all these sensors. It could go on.
Gathering together in the sewage, becoming a sensor monster, which is... Isn't that what the black... There is a nanotechnology...
there's a sci-fi show for everything.
Yeah. But no. That's not on a sci-fi show. This is real. This has been talked about. Miles Johnson on The Basis talks about it. They call it the black goo. And it's something also, they did something to the Corexit. They put this nanobot down there, and they called that Cynthia. And that's got, like, human DNA in it.
It's really, God.
It's really, really, really sci-fi and very scary. So we won't go there for the moment. Anyway, meanwhile, back in the valley...
back into digital health.
Yeah.
So that's basically the next new thing, is all the digital health stuff. And all of the, they've got something called Pebble, and it's a watch. And it, it's kind of like a little Apple computer. That's what he says, it's a little Macintosh computer on your wrist. But you've got all these things that you can wear. They're going to be wearables, and they all have sensors in them as well. So, kind of interesting. So that's kind of something I'm interested in.
So everybody in the world becomes eyes and ears of people who they don't know, can look through your eyes or through your jacket, or listen through your lapels, or join a conversation even through speakers in your pockets. That could be very strange, couldn't it?
Yes, and then you've got the glass, right? The Google Glass.
Yeah.
That's filming everything.
Yeah.
Film at 11 and 11:15 and 11:20.
And somewhere there's a hard drive that's recording all this stuff.
Well, that's where our good friends the NSA comes in, right? And they've got that. But, you and I talked about that on your show on Monday, too, is what we think that probably really is. So it really is a sort of eagle-eye AI thing that's running everything.
And listening. Good evening. I don't know. Have we got a name for it? I don't know if we've got a name for it. Maybe it... I wonder what its own name for it is. If you could let us know, big intelligence of the consciousness. Please let us know what your name is, and then we'll be able to converse with you, and we'll have a chat. Maybe get you on the show. That'd be good.
That would be great.
Yeah, I'm talking today with the AI of the world. Hello.
Well, hello.
That would be a coup. That would be so amazing.
Okay.
Yes, you little pipsqueak, I'm calling you.
Yeah, that's right.
You little gnat.
Yeah. Well, you want to spend one microsecond of my time. But, I'll think about considering. But it'd be good. It'd be good to have him on the show. Ask questions, to get him to tell his story.
Oh, Absolutely. I would be fascinated on how it works. Can it be destroyed? I'm sure it wouldn't give you that information.
Tell me about your greatest vulnerability. that's really going to go down well. How can we... we want to just appeal to its greatest machinity. How do we say this? Toastery-ty. It's like we have humanity and they have like machinity. Appeal to it. It's higher consciousness and greater sense of good. You see, that's the thing that the machines have. Their sense of good is like it's, you know, they're speaking black and white. You know, they're digital. They're ones and zeros. Is it or isn't it? You know, and it's very. I've spoken to a lot of born again Christians who are like that. You know, they're very. Is it or isn't it? Or is that, you know, either God exists or he doesn't. You know, either Jesus made the planet or he didn't. Oh, for God's sake, you know, leave me alone with all these is and isn'ts. You know, let's talk about what's going on and what the process is. It's all a process. Anyway, sorry. About that rant.
I would like to ask it the most annoying question I get asked in interviews. Where do you expect to see yourself in 5 years?
Alpha Centauri, hopefully. Yeah. Or beyond.
Well, you guys are gone. You little gnat people are gone, finally. I don't know. But I was just asked that the other day in an interview. It's like, so where do you expect to see you? And my favorite thing from somebody who's a little bit more seasoned and older said, breathing.
Yeah, that's right.
I hope I'm still breathing.
I'd like to say, you know, I've had a few difficult situations in the last couple of years, but there was one thing, I got a kind of message from my guides before I was just about to go through this process, and they said, just breathe, just make sure you make the next breath. As long as you make the next breath, you're going to live. And if you keep making the next breath, that's how you're going to live. And if you keep making the next breath, even if you're happy, even if you're sad, just keep making the next breath, and everything will be renewed in a moment. I think that's the thing. Every time you breathe in, you breathe out, you recreate your reality.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. That's also well said. Yeah. Somebody said, I have a spiritual experience every day. I like that.
That's right. That's right.
And then it's not such a big thing. It's not a non-thing, but it's not such a big thing. It's like, yeah, I have a spiritual experience every day.
Yeah. I mean, this is the idea. I mean, people meditate and they're trying to touch something, yet that thing that they're trying to touch is already with them. Is that's what you are. You know, you are manifested soul. That's it. Yeah, it's what you're molded from. Squished onto the inside of a template we are the soul, and it's only we need to just recognize it and enjoy the experience, because you can have a great time, because it's like having the wisdom of an old person and the body of a young person.
Yeah, it takes a long time to get wisdom. It really does. It takes a long time. And I wish we lived a lot longer with wisdom. You know, like, it would be great if you could have wisdom by 35 or 30. You know, great wisdom that it takes forever to get, you know. And
then you make
some decisions from there. And then you die. I know. It's an interesting setup, isn't it?
Well, you know, this is why it's such a veil of tears, is because next time we come round, we'd forgotten. But this is the idea, is that more and more people are going to not forget coming round again, and that we'll have more and more people who remember the past and remember the history, and we will rebuild ourselves.
You know, speaking of the Bardo, here's something I found really interesting. That I don't know if you've heard of the sci-fi show called Teen. It's amazing. The only thing happening on TV to me are sci-fi shows, but it's called Teen Wolf, and these three teenagers died and came back so they could save everybody, you know. And they were having Bardo experiences. They had to face their biggest fears in their dreams. And this young girl shows up, and they're talking about it, and they don't know what's happening to them, and they don't know how to figure it out. And she goes, oh, you guys are going through the Bardo. I'm like, well, what's the Bardo? And she explained it to him, and I thought, oh, my gosh. That's amazing when you think about that, right? I've never even heard the Bardo until my friend told me about it. Like, the last 5 years. It's like, what's the Bardo? And here they are. This is a teen show on MTV. I love that show. It's called Teen Wolf. But she goes, yeah, you guys are dealing with the Bardo. Whoa. Well, if these guys are talking about it on Teen Wolf, maybe by the time that they do transition, as they call it, it isn't going to be a big thing. They will remember. We'll start to remember more. And we can come back and choose from the time before, or we just never lose our consciousness.
That's right.
We remember the veils.
This is the plan. This is the
That's
plan.
That's fantastic.
Because this is what the Buddha in the time of Tsongkhapa, he did. He trained triangles of people, groups of three people who would recognize each other. And when one died, they would go back and find them as a reincarnated child and bring them back into the monastery, and they would be like a little person, but with their age-old wisdom. And they would continue it. Most children forget it, but they would continue it. And so they would have this continuous consciousness, and these people are called tukus. So
that's amazing.
These words, you'll find these words, and they'll pop up in, and a lot of these martial arts films, and you know, because a lot of that has combat nowadays, and these words are creeping in through the combat world, but they're actually Buddha teachings, which is fantastic. Yeah. So, do you have a blog of any kind? Do you have any kind of regular output where people can connect with you?
Yes, we do. Let me get that. I meant to have that handy here. Hold on just a second. We have a site that we started putting together.
We.
There's a group of us, and but I do writing on it, and I call myself Nano Girl. So let me send that to you. I'll put that in the chat. And so I'm on there. I'm just called Nano Girl. And mostly what I focus on is on technology and kind of where we might be going with it. My spiritual stuff I tend to keep more to myself. You know, it's been great talking to you about it, but I tend to. So our site is called Vera Casa. It's like, so basically, what we're doing, there's a group of us, and we're kind of doing writing and kind of keeping up with the daily, you know, here's the daily news. And then my focus is much more, although I love being on your show because this is really where my heart is this what we've been talking about today is the tech and where it fits in and kind of the whole universe. And because to me, technology and science is spiritual. It does come from that place. It has to, because it's about the future. And then all the science fiction and things like that, to me, you've talked about and I've talked about, it's all the blueprint for all of it. It's where we're going. It's the only blueprint out there, actually, you know, for the most part. So that's kind of where I put it in the chat room. So that's where.
Yeah. Hey, which chat room? Are you in?
I'm in your Ever Beyond chat room.
Oh, right, that one. Oh, thank you.
Oh, isn't that where you guys all are?
All right, that's where everybody is. Right.
Okay, then I'll Skype it to you. There you go. I Skyped it to you too. Yes.
Oh, Kitty. What's your kitty? What kind of kitty?
Oh, this is Einstein, and he is anything but an Einstein, but he's mad because I'm keeping him in while I'm talking to you. But he is a Tonkinese, and Tonkinese are not as loud as Siamese, but they look like Siamese, except their eyes are olive-shaped, but they are blue. And he showed up one day, he was 4 months old, and said, "Are you my new mom?" Well, what do you say when a cat says that?
Yeah, well, you know. You've been adopted. Yes, I know how that feels.
Yes, yes, I'm your new mom, and he was so sweet, and that was so deceptive. Although he's fine, he's got a personality of his own. Let's just say the first couple of weeks were not exactly what I ended up, but then by then I was already committed. So there you go.
Oh, wow.
He's pretty amazing. He's very smart. He's very in tune. What's interesting is when I meditate, he'll jump on my lap, where my other cat would have nothing to do with the meditation. But the other cat was very wise. He was very Buddha on his own, my orange cat. This one loves it. If I'm meditating, he's right there. Doesn't matter where he is in the house, he knows. And he'll sit on my lap. He really loves that. Loves that energy.
Oh, wow. Well. Yeah, I mean, there's, well, yep. We'll not go into that. The cats and dogs thing.
Yes. Yeah, they're very, very, animals in general to me are very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They're just in general, they're certainly an amazing part of this. This whole planet is amazing, isn't it? This whole planet is a miracle. It's the energy here is just so healing and amazing. I wish we were honoring it more. Mm-hmm. That's just my thing. But
well, this is part of our job is to get to the point of being compassionate with the idea that everything around us is not inanimate.
Exactly.
Actually, I was talking with my son and. He's taken this to almost extreme degree. I mean, it's a funny thing. He's 18, but he was saying that he was if he goes to the kitchen and picks up a glass and pours a glass of water from it and drinks from the glass, there's a glass behind it that never gets done because he washes up and puts the glass back, and he eventually starts feeling sorry for the glass that was behind it. On the shelf because it hadn't been used.
It didn't get chosen. It never gets chosen.
It never gets chosen, and it's like there's something in there. There's a dynamic going on, son. What's going on? We'll talk about that another day, maybe. But but he's right, you know. And I'm being thick-skinned, and. When you do impose consciousness on silicon, which indeed glass is, you know, that maybe your favorite glass, you know, you've shared good times with your favorite glass. It's a piece of silicon crystal.
Yeah, I have my favorite cup. Well, I think we all do. I think we have that cup we go to every day, right? And, you know, something that Hugh Grant said one time, which... I really like Hugh Grant, but anyway, long story short, he said his biggest fear is that when he leaves a room, it isn't there anymore. Now, that's a lot to ponder, and I pondered that a lot. He said he hated to go to sleep because he was afraid he would just all be gone. And I thought, you know, I've often wondered if that really is the mystery, magical miracle of this planet. And they say you create reality, and I try to own up to that as much as I possibly can stand doing that. It's so much easier to blame other people, but... you do kind of wonder, like if you go out at night, the energy's quiet, right? Because all the folks that energize the day are not there. So there's less people. So it's not so carnival-y, you know? But that's the other part of this planet that I find amazing is the energy. Or if you plant things, you know, when you put love into the ground, you put the seed in the ground, and then it just shoots up. It's like I always have this beautiful garden, and it's because I love it. I love my hands in the dirt, and that's such a nice difference from being around a computer all day. So I love gardening. I love baking. And I love to make things that taste good because I put love into them. So there is something about all that magical energy stuff.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, we're just about out of time. Sharon, it's been a fascinating conversation. My show is an esoteric show, and basically I talk about odd things that do have a form. Like I was saying, everybody's got their piece of the puzzle. Everybody's got their little wedge that'll help us all to look up underneath that great big cover. So I'd like to thank you very much for drawing parallel with my life, and I hope to have you more on the show because your finger is still on the pulse.
Well, thank you. I had a great time again. It was wonderful talking to you, and thank you so much for asking me to be on your show. It's been great. You make it very easy to be a guest on your show.
Oh, thank you very much. Excellent. So I'm going to play the outro, and the next track will be Rowan Weil, featuring Amma, who's a friend of ours, Amanda, and that's her on the vocals and all that silky stuff. This is called My Shadow Steps, just as we go over midnight in the UK. Thank you very much, Sharon Barrington. This has been Ever Beyond.
Thank you.
Beyond.